Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Stanzas, verse, iambic pentameter, style, form. To some, poetry is like a foreign language or even a foreign country. And reading poetry can even come off as pretentious in today's society. In generations past, it was more common to hear people reciting favorite poems out loud, by heart. Is there a way for people to recapture that love of poetry today? This hour on Point, a guide to getting your feet wet in the world of poetry. You can join the conversation. Are you intimidated by poetry? Have you found your way navigating the poetic waters? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook, at onpointradio. Joining me now from Ithaca, New York, is David Orr. He is the poetry critic for the New York Times Book Review and author of the new book, Beautiful and Pointless, A Guide to Modern Poetry. David, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, first of all, explain that title, Beautiful and Pointless.
Well, it's actually referring to a line from the book. When I'm talking about the way that poetry readers think about poetry, we have, and I think an especially close relationship with the art form that sort of resembles, well, love, for lack of a better word. And I think that there's something lovely about the relationship and also something, well, pointless seems a little harsh, but something in a sense that can't be balanced about that relationship, because after all, what you're talking about is an art form, not another person. But I think I'm also sort of referring to the sense in which poetry is kind of lovely and useless, and there's something really appealing about that uselessness.
Right up front, you say along those lines that poetry as an art form is, quote, enormous and perplexing, and at least half of it is of interest only to scholars and the certifiably disturbed. How would you say most people initially respond to poetry?
I think largely with bewilderment, if my own experience is any guide. And one of the points of the book is that the difficulty in learning about poetry for many people isn't really so much the bewilderment itself. After all, we're bewildered by lots of things. It's that they don't really expect to be bewildered. And then when they are bewildered, they feel as if they've done something wrong. But poetry is an incredibly complicated and in some cases very difficult art form, so of course you should be confused by it. And if you're comfortable with the confusion, then it's actually easier to move forward as a reader.
Another line that I like from the book, you write that poetry, quote, occupies a position in the popular consciousness somewhere between lute playing and cruel embroidery.
Yeah. What can I say? It's not a popular art form. But that doesn't mean it's not a worthy art form, and it doesn't mean that it's an art form that won't return the attention that you give it.
In your book, you say it's like taking a trip to Belgium reading poetry. How so? Explain that.
Well, what I mean is that if you think about poetry in the way that you think of a foreign country, it can be sort of helpful in negotiating the confusion that you find. I mean, after all, if you're going to go to another country, you don't expect to know everything about a country. You don't expect to suddenly speak Flemish because you're in Belgium. And you're not really that troubled when you don't know where all of their public transportation spots are. Poetry is a bit the same way. If you don't read a lot of poetry, there's no reason to think you're going to know your way around poetry. What you have to do is sort of the same thing that you do in a foreign country. You take what you can understand and you sort of move on from that. And I think that one of the problems, again, for many readers is that they have kind of the wrong metaphor in mind when they're thinking about reading poetry. They're not thinking about it as being something that is a little bit foreign to them. Instead, they're thinking about it as something that should be native to them but isn't.
So tell us the story, then, of how you personally came to poetry.
Well, actually, I came to poetry largely by mistake, as I think many people do. I was in college, and I was buying books for one of the large survey courses in the English department, you know, where they cover books from, period, the period sort of 18th century forward. And there were different sections in the class, and they each had different reading lists, and I wasn't really sure which section I had, so I bought all the books intending to return some. And one of the books that I bought was Philip Larkin's The Whitsun Weddings. It's a really tiny book, and when I was returning my books later, I actually forgot to return it. And then a few months later, I was looking at my bookshelves, and I saw this little book, and I said, why do I even have this book anymore? Started reading it, and I think for the first time really enjoyed poetry for what it is and not for what I thought it ought to be.
In fact, you write that it would not be an exaggeration to say that your world was instantly changed. We actually have Philip Larkin reading, the British poet Philip Larkin, reading The Trees from his 1974 collection High Windows. Here it is.
The trees are coming into leaf like something almost being said. The recent buds relax and spread. Their greenness is a kind of grief. Is it that they are born again and we grow old? No, they die too. Their yearly trick of looking new is written down in rings of grain. Yet still the unresting castles thresh in full-grown thickness every May. Last year is dead, they seem to say. Begin afresh, afresh, afresh.
So, David, what did you hear and read and imagine when you stumbled upon Philip Larkin?
I think several things at once. One of the most appealing things about Larkin for a beginning reader is that Larkin is very deliberately writing in the kind of language that people think they speak in their day-to-day life. If you actually look at Larkin's lines, they're very densely poetic, but they don't sound that way. They sound like something someone might say. Hmm. So this is one of the things that is very attractive when you first start reading him. But there's so many other qualities about Larkin that are also very attractive. I mean, he's sort of a master of traditional form. You can kind of hear it at the beginning of that poem. You can sort of hear the rhythm kick in as he says the trees are coming into leaf like something almost being said. And he has a preoccupation with a lot of things that I think really matter to people in their day-to-day lives. In that poem, you can sort of – what he's talking about is looking at trees and having an idea that they represent this kind of eternal life or eternal renewal. But of course, it's really a trick because trees die as well. And in a lot of Larkin's poems, there is this kind of constant balancing between illusion and disillusion. I mean, his first really mature collection was actually called The Less Deceived.
And in that you heard?
Well, I think the goal in Larkin's poetry is always to be one of the less deceived people. But there's also, again, a balancing tendency. One always wants to be a little bit deceived because part of life is finding loveliness in things like trees and thinking for a moment, oh, they represent eternity, when in reality you know that they don't, just as we often like to think that we ourselves are going to live forever, although, of course, we realize we can't.
Here's another poem from one of the most well-known and well-regarded modern poets, Kay Ryan. She's a former U.S. poet laureate and won the 2011 Pulitzer Prize for Poetry. Here she is reading Home to Roost from her collection The Niagara River at New York City's Kay Playhouse in 2006.
The chickens are circling and blotting out the day. The sun is bright, but the chickens are in the way. Yes, the sky is dark with chickens, dense with them. They turn, and then they turn again. These are the chickens you let loose, one at a time and small, various breeds. Now they have come home to roost, all the same kind, at the same speed.
It's the way she reads it, too. I mean, I know that words are beautiful and how it's written is so melodic and lovely, but what do you hear in that?
Oh, I actually agree with you. I think she's a really great reader. Mm-hmm. I had not heard her read before, and it's really been nice to hear some of the recordings because some poets are good at reading their own material and some aren't, and Kay Ryan is excellent at it. I mean, in a poem like that, there are actually a number of ways to read that poem, and I'm sure Kay Ryan has something in mind, and any interpretation I would offer, she'd probably laugh at and tell me I was overdoing it. But for me anyway, there are sort of two things that are really interesting about that poem. The first thing is that, and this is typical of many of Kay Ryan's poems, it's formally very interesting. Unfortunately, your listeners can't see the poem, but the poem is actually very skinny. complex technical term I just employed there. But what I mean is that it's skinny. It's only a few lines across. And the rhymes that you hear when Kay Ryan reads it are internal rhymes. And they're very, very carefully arranged in the poem. So as your eye goes down the page, you kind of hit the rhymes and then skip over like a stone kind of skipping across the water. And then the other thing I think that's really interesting about that poem is the ending. It's so hard to see exactly what she means. And yet at the same time, you sort of do know what she means. I mean, why did the chickens come home all at the same speed? I've actually thought about this a good bit. And I mean, to me anyway, what she's suggesting is that the decisions that you make in life, the minor ones and the major ones, set off these chains of causation that cause you later in life to be in a certain position. But you don't actually ever get to see where those chains come from or how far they spiral out. They all just kind of hit you at once when you realize that you are who you are at whatever age you may be.
In fact, one of the phrases from that poem you talk about in your political chapter of your book, because the phrase America's chickens are coming home to roost.
Right. It's one of the interesting things about poetry is that so many poems have different applications in different circumstances. And in the chapter that you're talking about, in which I'm sort of discussing the ways in which American poets think about politics, and they do think about politics quite a lot, one of the points that I'm making is that after September 11th, a lot of poems were used for the purpose of grief or commemoration rather, and Ryan's was one of them, but she actually wrote it before September 11th. Mm-hmm. So there's no way she actually had that purpose in mind.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the pleasures of poetry. Joining me this hour from Ithaca, New York, is David Orr, poetry critic for the New York Times Book Review. His fantastic new book is called Beautiful and Pointless, A Guide to Modern Poetry. David, calls are rolling in here, so let's hear from a listener right out of the gate here. Cheryl is in Kingston, Rhode Island. Hi, Cheryl. Welcome.
Hi, Jane and David. Two quick things to respond to things that David has said. One is that I think Garrison Keillor has done a wonderful job of being the Oprah of poetry for many American citizens who may not have had an appreciation of poetry before, either through his little poetry spots in public radio or through the volumes Good Poems for Hard Times, which I see popping up in the most unlikely of places, which I think is encouraging. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that I teach philosophy of art at a public institution where many of my students have no background whatsoever in poetry other than that which they were force-fed in high school. And one exercise I do is to put two poems side by side by the same author, in this case Michael Donaghy, the late, sadly died very young, American poet who lived in London. And one of the poems is in the apparent vernacular about the death of his father and very accessible to the students. And the other poem is highly elusive and dense with signifiers and allusions and at first frustrating for them. And we do this, we spend an entire class on these two poems as a way of unwrapping the character of poetry, the various avenues into it. And I find that if they can start with the more accessible poetry and then in a short order get to the more difficult poetry and work through the allusions with them, their appreciation is heightened and often an appetite whetted. Mm. Thank you.
That's a wonderful story, Cheryl. Thank you.
I was just going to say that I really agree with what Cheryl just said. I think it's a great way to teach poetry. And particularly as she's sort of suggesting with the same author. I mean, it's a really good idea. Now, you can't do this with every poet, of course, but if you take a poet like Michael Donaghy, and I agree with her also that he's a very good poet, who can work in multiple registers, it's really helpful sometimes to sort of give somebody something where the language at least looks approachable, and then you sort of move into language that's more obviously complicated.
What makes a good poem, a good poet, David?
Oh, my gosh. That's a really good question. I don't know. I think what makes a good poet is probably going to vary from person to person a good bit. What makes a good poet for me, at this point in my life anyway, and this might change later, I think it's just a sense in reading the person's work of complete command of their technique coupled with a willingness to relinquish that command when it seems appropriate. And I know that's just a really vague way to put things, but honestly, that's the best I think I can do.
Here's another poem from a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, Paul Muldoon. He's a New Yorker poetry editor and a professor at Princeton. Lots of his poems touch upon his Irish roots, and here he is reading his poem, The Sonogram, the first in a series of three poems about the arrival of his daughter.
Only a few weeks ago, the sonogram of Jean's womb resembled nothing so much as a satellite map of Ireland. Now the image is so well defined, we can make out not only a hand, but a thumb. On the road to Spittal, a woman hitching a ride. A gladiator in his net, passing judgment on the crowd.
David Orr, you talk in your book and use Muldoon actually as an example of a poet who sometimes uses a hybrid of different forms of his work.
That's right. It's a thing that Muldoon is known for. He really tweaks forms in exciting ways, and he's sort of a master in particular of the sonnet, which he can do all kinds of tricks with. One of the real pleasures of reading certain poets is just watching them go through these crazy maneuvers in form, and I think Muldoon is about as good as it gets. I'm sort of thinking, it's really funny once, speaking of people sort of learning about poetry, one of my friends in law school, and I probably should mention this point, I am a lawyer and went to law school, so I have sort of an atypical poetry career. but I started as a critic in law school, and so I would often end up in conversations about poetry with people who are training to be lawyers. And I still remember talking about form with a friend of mine and trying to explain the villanelle, which is a poem with refrains. And your listeners might remember Dylan Thomas's Do Not Go Gentle Into That Good Night. That's a villanelle. And I was trying to explain it, and I said, well, you know, let me show you two poems. And so I showed him one villanelle that was very, very regular and, as people would say, I guess, accessible. And I showed him another one that was by Muldoon that was completely crazy. And, of course, I assumed as a poetry reader that he would like the normal poem. But, in fact, he really preferred Muldoon's. And it's – I always remember that when I think about the tendency that we sometimes have as critics to think that readers who aren't specialists are going to have – they're always going to prefer things that look a little easier. I mean, often they don't.
Here's a call now from Bill in Northborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Bill. Welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. 2 points. One, I have a quote here from Robert Frost, which pretty much says it all, and also a comment about how poetry strikes people and what they need to know and how difficult they find it. The quote from Robert Frost, quote, "It is absurd to think that the only way to tell if a poem is lasting is to wait and see if it lasts." The right reader of a good poem can tell the moment it strikes him that he has taken an immortal wound, that he will never get over it. That is to say, permanence in poetry, as in love, is perceived instantly. It hasn't to await the test of time. The proof of a poem is not that we have never forgotten it, but we knew at sight we never could forget it. Unquote. Honest to God, how else would you describe poetry? And another point to be brought up here. In the 19th century, in the Wild West, believe it or not, Shakespeare was very, very popular among people without education. You know, backwoodsmen, people who are semi-illiterate or illiterate. They weren't afraid to have a reach beyond, a reach beyond their grasp, if I could quote Pope out of context. They weren't afraid to stretch their mind, so to speak. But I don't see that in a lot of people today. You know, they don't want to put effort into poetry because it takes too much effort.
Bill, thank you. David Orr.
I actually really enjoy the Frost quote. Frost has so many great quotes about poetry. Some of them are obviously right. Some of them are a little questionable, but they're always interesting. And I think what's particularly interesting about that quote that Bill brought up is that what Frost is talking about there is the sense that you sometimes have with poems of immediate impact, that you knew something that you didn't know before and you're not even sure how you know it. And I think that that is something that happens with quite a lot of poems. It doesn't happen all the time with all poems, and sometimes you find that as you get older, things that had no impact on you before suddenly have a very great impact indeed. The other thing I'd like to say is it's hard for me to judge an age of people. I know what Bill's talking about when he says that it seems sometimes that people don't really want to work so hard now. But I guess it depends. People will work quite hard at things that they feel basically comfortable with. And so one of the problems with poetry is that there just isn't the comfort level. Although I guess, you know, if he's right that there were cowboys running around reciting Shakespeare, maybe that's not so true.
Bill, thanks so much for the call. A lot of listeners on our Facebook page. Here's one, Soli, who says, the more you read poetry, the more you come to understand it. I used to loathe poetry and never really got why people wanted to read it. I'm still not a big poetry reader, but my love for it grows as I get older. In the book, David Orr, you actually say that poetry fans don't just love poetry a little, they really love it. And to test that hypothesis, you did a little experiment with the help of Google. Can you tell us about it?
Sure. What I tried to do, and let me just stress at the beginning, this is hardly a scientific experiment.
Indeed, but it's fun to read and hear about.
Still fun to read, absolutely. Yeah. So what I did was I looked at a bunch of different activities, and for each activity, I would put a search into Google. One search was, I like whatever the activity is, and then the other search would be, I love whatever the activity is. And what I saw over a period of roughly a week and a half of repeatedly doing these searches, which you have to do because Google shifts their databases around, is that poetry, more than any other activity, would register very strongly in the I love the activity search. So in other words, people were saying I love poetry a lot more than they were saying I like poetry. And in fact, this ratio was really heavily skewed toward the love formulation for poetry, far beyond the way in which it would be skewed for, you know, for example, cooking or tennis or something like that, in which case people were much more comfortable saying, I like whatever the activity might be.
Here's a call from Nasser in Boston. Welcome, Nasser. You're on the air.
Hello, Jane.
Hello.
Listen, I just want to bring this point to you because I come from the Indian continent, and I, you know, my observation is there's a lack of culture of poetry generally in the Western countries. I remember when I was dating here as a college student, and I used to read poetry to the ladies I'm dating, and they used to get baffled, and you know, and slowly and gradually that, you know, it shut me down. But in our continent, when you go to a poetry reading, it was like going to a rock concert. Believe it or not. People get so excited, and you know, the poet was treated as, you know, rock stars. I don't see that kind of enthusiasm in this culture, and I'm really saddened when I heard your guest saying it's like going to Belgium reading poetry, and this is really a sad story. I remember in college, There was one of our classmates will stand up before the teacher comes in the class, in front of the class, and read poetry. And he was a very enthusiastic, you know, he wasn't a poet himself. He was enthusiastic about poetry. And he specifically liked a very famous poet called Faz Ahmed Faz. And he used to, you know, publish a poem once a week. And he couldn't wait. He could not wait to get his poem and read it to the classmate. And
he loved it that much. Yeah, Nasser, I'm really glad you called, David Orr. Let me ask you about those cultural differences. How do they play into this?
Well, the caller is exactly right. In different cultures, you have a different appreciation for poetry. You know, Russia notoriously, or I guess famously, actually, really embraces poets and has had poets who were widely, widely known and recited. And it's not the case so much in the West, maybe a little bit in Ireland, but not in America. And, it, you know, it is what it is. Different countries have different approaches to the art form. I mean, I certainly sympathize with the caller in his experience in reading poetry to women he was courting. We've all gone down that road, and it never ends well.
Here's another call from Ron. But don't give up, Nasser. Don't give up.
Right. Don't give up. It might work.
From Williamsburg, Virginia, here's Ryan. Welcome to On Point. Ryan, hello.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
How are you doing?
Well, thank you.
Okay, so what I wanted to bring up was I wanted to know what Mr. Orr had to say about the perceived difference between song lyrics and what you would call poetry. And the best example I can provide would be the alt-country singer-songwriter Ryan Adams. I don't know if you are familiar with him, but... In 2009, he released a volume of his own poetry called Infinity Blues, and it's very good, but when you know him as a singer, it's like, well, what is the difference?
Good question. Ryan, thank you. David Orr.
I think it's a great question. It comes up a lot. What is the difference? Sometimes the difference is pretty hard to see. I mean, formally, lyricists are using poetic devices. So in a sense, they are writing poems. But of course, when they're writing the words down, they aren't thinking, I'm writing a poem. They're thinking, I'm writing song lyrics, and they're thinking about music usually. So there is a difference just in intention there. But as I said, that can get a little dicey sometimes, because often when you look at the lyrics on the page, they're really good and they work as poems. So I think I'm pretty happy for the line between poetry and song lyrics to be fairly blurry sometimes. And often on the flip side of this, some poems can be set to music and they work quite well. And many, many poets have written songs and have worked as librettists. So I think we don't really need a firm divide. I think we can just sort of be content to be uncertain.
Let's hear another poem, David. This from Elizabeth Bishop. She's regarded as one of the great poets of the 20th century. She was born in 1911 and lived until 1979. Here she is on a recording released in 1950, reading her poem called Late Air.
From a magician's midnight sleeve, the radio singers distribute all their love songs over the dew-wet lawns. And like a fortune teller's, their marrow-piercing guesses or whatever you believe. But on the Navy Yard aerial, I find better witnesses for love on summer nights. Five remote red lights keep their nests there, phoenixes burning quietly where the dew cannot climb.
What do you hear in that, David?
Well, it's a great poem. I mean, almost all of Bishop's poems are great poems. She's notorious pruner as a poet, and her complete poems is quite short. I think that at least one of the things that she's getting at there is it's actually somewhat similar to some of Larkin's poems in the sense that she's talking about the illusions that we have about belief and about love, particularly at the beginning of the poem where she's talking about the radio singers and comparing them to magicians, such that whatever they're saying ends up being whatever we believe. And she comes down in favor of actually the lights that are on the radio antenna rather than the songs themselves, which she then compares to phoenixes, which makes her a little bit of a radio singer herself.
I'm curious as a poet and a critic for the New York Times Book Review, do you see poetry changing or evolving in any way with the times?
Oh, sure. Poetry always changes. We go through period styles, and some poems in those styles are more successful than others. And actually, one of the problems we sometimes have in the poetry world is that we get very caught up in what we think people are going to think 50 years from now or 100 years from now. And we are sometimes a little bit harsh on things that are written just to sort of be interesting in our own period. So I guess even just in the short time it's not that short. Good gracious, I've been a critic for 12 years now. It seems short. Even just in the period I've been working, I've seen poets very slightly shift their emphasis. Not poets who have been working for a long time, but younger poets usually.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're talking about poetry today and how to understand it. Poet and poetry critic David Orr is with us this hour. And joining me now from Santa Monica, California, is Carol Muskie Dukes. She is the Poet Laureate of California. She has an upcoming book of poetry due out in June called Twin Cities. She is co-editor of the new book, Crossing State Lines, a collaborative poem of 54 poets across the country. Carol, welcome.
Hi.
May I ask you first off, I've never been able to ask a poet laureate of anywhere, what is your job? What do you do?
Well, most poet laureates don't do much. It started out as an honorific that came across the ocean to us from England. But it happens in the state of California that the poet laureate is appointed by the governor's office. And the governor asked that the poet laureate not only do readings around the state, but also have a project, a statewide project with the goal of reaching communities that would not be necessarily touched touched by poetry. I guess from our conversation earlier, your conversation earlier, mm-hmm. that would take in most mm-hmm. of the world. But in this case, for my statewide project, I specifically tried to reach out to the kids in the California public school system, beleaguered public school mm-hmm. system, mm-hmm. and in terms of poetry. So I put together a collection called the Magical Poetry Blimp Pilot's Guide. And it's the Magic Poetry Blimp, or it was called the Magic Poetry Bus. It's at magicpoetrybus.org. It's really an imaginary vehicle, and, you know, lots of poets contributed to this collection, which is they're a series of exercises, actually, to bring kids to poetry, fun exercises. Mm. You know, so we have donated poems by Robert Pinsky and Billy Collins and Garrison Keillor and all that, but we also have chapters written by you know, student writers and writers and poets about particular forms of poetry, haiku, sonnet, and so on. And in a way, we hope it's going to reach kids. We believe in learning poetry by heart, or I do. I was brought up with a mother who recited poems. She came from that last generation of Americans who learned poems by heart.
How do you see the kids in California that you're reaching out to, that you're teaching, that you're trying to touch through poetry? How do you see them responding to it?
Well, so far it's been pretty extraordinarily successful in that, you know, I want to just comment a little bit about what's been said earlier about accessibility. I don't think accessibility is necessarily the point, but I think it's a sense of spontaneity, you know, a sense that it is happening right now, the poem, or the illusion of some kind of discovery. It's what the end of the Larkin poem is, a fresh. And John Keats said, poetry should come as leaves to a tree, which also speaks to the Larkin poem. But if kids feel that they are discovering something in poetry, that they are, it's somehow, you know, for the first time they're hearing a poem and they're memorizing a poem, let's say, and it makes sense to them in a way, emotionally and imaginatively, that touches them, that means much more than it being easy, I think, or accessible. Mm. You know, there's the whole movement, of course, spoken word and poetry slams and so on, and I think the reason for their great success is, in fact, this sense of spontaneity. And
well, let me ask you more about the poetry slams, because it is one of the most popular genres of poetry today, especially among kids and youth poets. It can take a lot of forms, but the emphasis is on the performance. So we pulled a little bit. Here's Tyler Molly performing What Teachers Make at the 2000 National Poetry Slam in Providence.
I make kids work harder than they ever thought they could. I can make a C+ feel like a Congressional Medal of Honor, and I can make an A- feel like a slap in the face. How dare you waste my time with anything less than your very best? You want to know what I make? I make kids sit through 40 minutes of study hall in absolute silence. No, you cannot work in groups. No, you can't ask a question, so put your hand down.
Carol Muskie-Dukes, tell us about this phenomenon of poetry slam, and is that really poetry?
Well, it's funny. I didn't used to think it was, and I used to believe it belonged in the category only of performance. But then it's funny. Taylor Molly invited me to appear on stage at the Bowery, Bob Holman's Bowery Poetry Club in New York, and he created a series called Page versus Stage, and I was to appear as the page poet. You know, I teach at the University of Southern California. I dislike the term very much, academic poet, because I think poets appear in universities or not. They're philosophers, mm-hmm, they, mm-hmm. you know, appear in universities. It's mm-hmm. where poets work, wherever they are. And so I came as the page poet, and with skepticism, and our competition was set up on stage between Ainsley Burroughs, who's a spoken word poet, slam poet, and myself, and it was wonderful. It was absolutely wonderful.
What was wonderful about it?
Well, I saw that there was a way to connect. At least I learned something. That mm-hmm. is to say, mm-hmm. I learned that in Ainsley Burroughs' case, what he had written on the page, he had published a book of poems on the page. But it, you know, he was able to, you know, again create that sense of spontaneity that I was talking about earlier. And I wasn't just, you know, I admired the words that he wrote, and I admired the way the words came alive in that process on stage. And so I, you know, I took it home with me. That is to say, now this project that I was talking about with Magic Poetry, Buzz Blimp, whatever,
mm-hmm.
We partnered with a teen literacy organization called Get Lit, Words Ignite. And what these kids do, what these inner-city teen poets do, Get Lit does, is they combine, they learn canonical or traditional poems, great poems in quotes, by heart. They learn, you know, Wordsworth and Langston Hughes and Eliot, T.S. Eliot, and then they respond with their own spoken word poems mm-hmm. within the poem itself. Mm-hmm. We have at magicpoetrybus.org, we have these kids reciting, which they've learned by heart, Robert Pinsky's The Shirt, and then responding to the poem within the poem itself. Mm-hmm. Because I think where the two come together is the point.
Mm-hmm. It's an incredible way to reach kids, and we so appreciate your time today, and especially your efforts there in California. And my goodness, let's hope these kids latch on. Carol Muskie Dukes from Santa Monica, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Carol Muskie Dukes is the Poet Laureate of California and author of the forthcoming poetry collection, Twin Cities. Back to the phones and to David Orr. Here's Brent in Lexington, Kentucky. Hi, Brent. Thanks for waiting. Welcome.
Oh, no problem. Hello. I'm an educator and I'm also a poet myself, and I think that one of the things that's overlooked as the poet laureate just said, is that a lot of kids nowadays understand poetry because they understand spoken word and because they understand hip-hop. And I think what I tend to do in my workshops with inner-city youth when we talk about poetry is that I try to bring in hip-hop lyrics that they understand, that they're exposed to, and then compare that to some more traditional poetry, things like Nikki Giovanni and Langston Hughes. I also think that it's important that we not try to put poetry on any kind of hierarchy, saying that maybe spoken word is not poetry because it focuses on performance, and saying that a more great poem like a Wordsworth or something like that is poetry because it's not focused on performance. Hmm. I think it is what it is, and I think for us to put it on a hierarchy only damages more the image of poetry for young people.
Brent, I'm glad you called. I hear your point, and I want to hear David Orr respond to it. Thank you, Brent.
Yeah, I largely agree with what he has to say. I think that using hip-hop lyrics to teach poetry is a really good idea. When I was a kid, I guess when I was in 9th or 10th grade, I remember one of my English teachers using song lyrics. And I think we were all supposed to find song lyrics, and then we were going to talk about them as poems. And as I said earlier, the boundary between these things is pretty blurry. And I tend to agree with the caller that we don't need to be super aggressive about enforcing it. I mean, we really don't know where good writers are going to come from, and it's not really our place to foreclose the opportunities.
Here's another call from Boston. Ocean is on the line. Hi, Ocean. Welcome.
Hello. I think people don't like to spend time unless they are useful and funny. And my son won the regional poetry out loud on May 5th. It's mm-hmm. not because of his reading the poem, because actually he's acting on it. And mm-hmm. he's loved because he thinks he was in the movie. Mm-hmm. And I'm a medical scientist. I wrote poem. I read my poem before my science seminar in the mm-hmm. international conference,
mm-hmm.
and the audience remember my poem more than my science.
Oh, that's interesting.
But one thing I want to say, that creating new poem with good sustenance had to be something sustenance, had to be something new, had to be something touch people's life, had to be contagious, viral, and fun. And this is really exciting to inspire children. They will be creating their own poem, something new. As Obama said, this is the 21st century, and things keep changing, but we have to be useful, right?
Contagious, wild, fun. That is, that's the ticket. David?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's probably the right spirit. It's actually pretty similar to what Carol Muskie Dukes was talking about when
that's
she was
right.
saying, quite rightly, I think, that one of the real points of reading poetry is that sense of discovery. And I really agree with her about that. I think that part of the point that I am trying to make in the introduction to my book is that when I use that metaphor of a foreign country, well, discovery is exactly what you do in a foreign country. And it's the kind of thing you should be expecting from poetry. I mean, one thing that we get sort of caught up in the poetry world sometimes, and we can get kind of cranky about, is the idea of popularizing poetry. And I think one thing to bear in mind always is that there's a difference between trying to popularize something and trying to educate people about something. I mean, we don't think of teachers as being popularizers because what they're really trying to do is provide us with the context to understand a new form. Whereas, you know, somebody who's popularizing is essentially somebody who's advertising. They're just kind of spreading poems around willy-nilly with no concern about allowing people to approach them in a way that helps them to feel an appropriate level of discomfort, maybe. I mean, as Carol said, it's really not about things being easy at all. And that's really one of the points in my book, actually.
Here's another call from Sean in Saxton's River, Vermont. Hi, Sean. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I think all great points today. We have the luxury. I'm a head of a school, a small residential school. And so I get a chance. We have dinner every Tuesday night as a community. And obviously, April being Poetry Month, we were able to get out the other day, and I just got to be stand up and read two poems, Whitman's Learned Astronomer and Emily Dickinson's Narrow Fellow in the Grass. And, you know, any kid can relate to being bored in a lecture hall and getting up and wanting to go out and see something different. Obviously, Whitman's deeper meanings are there, too, but I think you have to get the word out and just let people speak poems to communities whenever they get the opportunity, mm-hmm. dinner or whatever.
Good for you, Sean. Thanks for your work. Here's Bob in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Hi, Bob. Welcome to On Point.
Jane.
Hi.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
I agree with this last caller. What we do here is we started doing readings with pretty renowned poets like Tom Williams and Tim Siebold. And we left the coffee shops and bookstores of 10 people and went into major clubs like the Jewish Mother, and now we're getting 150 and 200 people showing up. Mm. And it's standard poetry. We're not doing poetry slams. But I don't think it's as difficult to understand or inaccessible as people think once they're exposed to it. Mm. We teach it in the college classrooms, then we go out and do our own stuff, and the students are more than responsive that they keep coming back with more people.
Mm. Bob, I'm glad you called. Thank you very much. David Orr, I want to get a story in from your book because you write so movingly about your dad and your final days with him after his battle with cancer and a stroke and your connection to him that you made with him through poetry. Would you tell us that story?
Sure. It's an interesting story of connection and disconnection at the same time, I guess. But my father died of cancer, and as I'm sure many listeners will know, that's usually a progressive disease, and in his case, went on for several months. And at one point, one of the side effects of the cancer was that he had a stroke, and strokes do various things to people, but one of the things that they can do is they can really affect your speech patterns such that you have what's called flat affect, which means that you say almost everything in exactly the same monotone. And you also tend to run your words together so that everything sounds almost exactly the same. I mean, you could be saying, you know, help, we're being attacked, exactly the same way you'd say this wine is delicious. And so I was at home trying to help out as much as I could, and we were doing various exercises with him, and I thought, well, you know, I'm a poetry critic. What would be better to help Dad learn to talk again than poetry? Because, of course, poetry is often very rhythmic. It involves a lot of pausing. It involves a lot of putting emphasis on things. And so I tried all of these poems with him that I thought, you know, being a poetry critic, were really great poems, and, of course, he would get a lot out of them. And it was interesting because I would read these poems that I thought were terrific, and he would sort of he thought they were interesting, but he wasn't really that moved by them. And in particular, one Robert Frost poem that I really love, he found something interesting in it, but it didn't have the impact that I had hoped it would. But then finally, we ended up with Edward Lear and The Owl and the Pussycat, which my mother had remembered that he had liked before he was sick and when he was a little boy, actually, I think. And you know, he was just completely delighted by it and would recite that poem over and over and over again. So in a sense, there was actually a connection because my father actually found a poem that meant a great deal to him. But in a sense, there was also this disconnection because it wasn't one of the things that I was trying to do. And I think what it helped to sort of remind me is that poetry hits people in very strange ways. And it's always risky as a critic to sort of enforce too much the consensus of other critics. You have to let people do their own thing a bit.
What would you say to adults or to kids about becoming engaged with poetry?
Well, I would say, again, just to go back to what Carol said, you know, don't expect it to be easy. It's not the job of poets and critics to tell you everything and feed everything to you. It's your job to be comfortable with your discomfort and to be willing to do some work. And if you do that, the art form has a lot to offer.
The fourth graders in my kids' school have a tradition of memorizing and reciting poetry, and there's really something magical, I must say, about hearing children engaged in poetry. I know you feel the same, David.
Oh, yeah. Children are really great readers of poetry. In particular, high school kids are great readers of many contemporary poets. Now, some poets, not so much, because some poets are writing about things that tend to be issues for people later in life. But many poets, kids are great because they're not afraid to ask hard questions, which is one of the important things of being a poetry reader.
I was delighted by your book. It was a wonderful read and really enlightening. Thank you for writing it, and thank you for being here today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation on our website and get the On Point podcast at onpointradio.org. David Orr was our guest this hour. His book is Beautiful and Pointless, A Guide to Modern Poetry. For an excerpt, go to our website, again at onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. Have a great weekend, everybody. This is On Point.